Okay, guys, here we are at part two. Actually, after I did part one, which again had that technical problem, so I had to break part one into part 1A and part 1B. But after I did that, I saw one of you sent me an email saying that you really liked that last lecture with the simulation, that we may be in a simulation and everything like that. Now, that was a more abbreviated thing of what I usually cover. If you're interested in the human upgrades and things like that, that would fall under a category called transhumanism or posthumanism, if you want to look that up. Usually I do bring that up, and in fact, I haven't checked recently, but previous times I've talked about it, I know that people have actually not wanted to even wait for these technological developments, and they've started performing surgeries on each other, just basic surgeries, like putting magnets in their fingertips and things like that, so they can gain that additional sense, you know, of magnetic fields around them and everything like that. They're upgrading themselves already. So if you wanted to check into that, and to the one about, you know, the email I got, which I appreciated, was more so about being in a simulation and everything like that. Now that too, I tend to go into on a deeper level. I mean, one of the things is people there, as I mentioned, I think in the lecture I mentioned that there are a bunch of people out there who believe we're in a simulation. Elon Musk, I believe, thinks it's more likely that we're in a simulation than not. The guy who created Dilbert, those Dilbert cartoon strips, he believes it's much more likely that we're in a simulation than not. And really, one of the arguments that would be made for it is that, you know, we can make far more simulations of anything. Like, think of it like a video game or movies or anything like that. The simulated world would far outnumber the one real world. And we're not even getting into the multiverse argument where there may be multiple universes and everything like that. But basically, one real world, and then you can have many, many, many simulated worlds. So statistically, it's argued it would be much more likely that we're in a simulated world than a real one. And then I would wonder, you know, because also there's this idea, the simulated worlds, they think they're real. And they would probably make their own simulated worlds. And maybe those simulated worlds would make their own simulated worlds. And it would be like an endless ladder up and down of these different worlds, and reality all just blends together. It becomes indistinguishable, the simulation and the reality, because there's so many different levels. And this is what I was saying. I don't think I brought this up before in a lecture, but whenever you make a copy, it's never really perfect. It's really got some little deviations or flaws and everything like that. And when you make a copy of a copy, it's going to have more problems. And a copy of a copy of a copy is going to have more problems, and so forth. And I personally wondered if maybe these things which seem odd or irrational or whatever it is maybe because we're further down that chain of simulated worlds. We're not only a simulated world of a real world, but a simulated world of a simulated world of a simulated world. So these things that we see, whether they be hurricanes, natural disasters, the coronavirus, these types of things, hypothetically, it could be that the simulation is kind of breaking down, that like a computer program that's been copied and recopied, and or even just data. When you keep copying it and copying it, the chances of it being corrupted go up and up and up. So that's one perspective. And in fact, Aldous Huxley wrote he was an earlier individual, maybe this world is another world's hell. That's one perspective. It's one perspective. Another one is this astronaut, you know, bringing it around to that technology again, space and whatnot. He actually took a different approach, and he said, you go to heaven when you're born. You know, most people think, oh, when you die, I hope I get to heaven and everything like that. His argument was going into space, being one of the first people to see the Earth from space, you go to heaven when you're born. You come into this big, beautiful world with water, and the climate is just right, and the food is just right, and everything like that, to support life. You look at all the universe that we know of, would not support our life. It might barely support our life. There's water in our solar system on certain moons and whatnot, but nothing. We've never found anything close to the Earth. So these are just different perspectives and different ways of looking at the world. Even though I, for example, don't at all believe we're in a simulation, it's thought-provoking to think about it and to consider these things. And also, you know, when it comes to meaning, what would that mean for us if we were? Even more than that, yeah, I kept talking about how technology keeps advancing and advancing at incredible speeds. And yeah, I think I gave that example of a birthday card, which another writer came up with. We use it and then we just throw it away. Like it's nothing. This would have been super advanced technology for people who are still alive today. Back in the 1940s or whatever it is, it would have been mind-bending technology. We just throw it in the garbage once it sings that happy birthday song to us. What if our world, what if our entire universe is not only some simulated thing, but frankly just a screensaver on some kid's computer 1,000 years from now? That's it. As soon as he moves his mouse, everything that we've done and been and existed and everything like that disappears. I don't know. Now, we see in this time period that we're talking about now, right around 1900, the early 1900s, America expanded its territory massively. We bought Alaska from Russia, and then we took the Hawaiian Islands in the early 1800s. When we had gotten there, there were missionaries, there were sugarcane growers, and everything like that. And ultimately, in this time period, we took it. And the thing is, that's why you have that TV show that. Cop show Hawaii 5-0, which they recently remade, because Hawaii was the 50th state admitted into the Union, the last state we actually made into our Union. And that's why we call the police 5-0. That's why that's the slang term comes from. It's that old cop show. Now, we also added territories. We annexed Samoa. You don't need to know these little things, but just understand we really expanded heavily, and this is pushing us further and further into the Pacific Ocean. So you have the west coast of America, which is California, and then you have the Pacific Ocean. And then beyond that, you have Japan and China and everything like that. So just understand, because we'll be getting to World War II, we keep getting closer and closer into that area and closer involved in that area, especially because we really want to continue and grow trade with China. So that's fine. Also, on our side of things, near Florida and whatnot, there was a war with Spain, and I'll let you read about it in the chapter. But we won, and Cuba became an American protectorate. And Puerto Rico and Guam became territories. We also, from Spain, got the Philippines. But the Philippines was a very different situation. The Philippines, we helped them get liberated from Spain, but they expected their independence. And then we tried to take over. They fought very, very aggressively for a very long time. It wasn't until around 1946, decades and decades later, that they just gave up. Even in Latin America, We now again, our country goes coast to coast. We expanded all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Okay, that's great. But now how do we reach there? By ocean. You see, to sail all around South America, all around Central and South America, every time we want to get from one place to the other, is a problem not only for us, but for the whole world. Well, there's a very narrow strip. There's land blocking the whole way until you round off South America. But there's a very, very narrow strip of land in Panama. In Panama, it gets so narrow that we decide, you know what? In fact, the French were the first to come up with the idea to build some huge, huge canal. So that would cut the distance of travel between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans massively. Massively, if they could just dig a canal over. Now, they couldn't do it. The French couldn't do it. But we were interested. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, he said, yeah, no, we'd be interested in doing that. And we worked it out with the French where we would be able to do that. Now, at this time, the area, Panama, was controlled by Colombia. And even though people said, no, some in America said, no, we made this deal with the French had worked it out with the Colombians and everything like that, we bought the rights from the French, now we don't have to pay anybody anything. Roosevelt still said, no, you know what, we in the American government said, no, we'll work something out just so that it's completely free and clear, there's no ambiguity, and we made Colombia an offer. Colombians said, well, no, we're interested in selling, but we want double the amount of money. At this, especially Roosevelt got really, really, really upset. And he worked it out so that we supported Panama's fight for independence, and Panama became independent. We gave the same deal to the Panamanians, which we had offered to Colombia. They took it, and then we were able to build that canal, partly because we had new blasting technology was invented, and also a way to deal with the malaria that was there. Now, again, I'm going over a lot of this stuff quite briefly, especially Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, you have mountains of books written about him. You could take a whole class on him, a full semester at the graduate level. But anyway, you can read about those things if you want. We have to move on here. Roosevelt finishes his second term and he has his handpicked successor, William Howard Taft, who is going to win. He's definitely going to win. Remember, we just had sometime back, decades ago, we had the American Civil War, and the Republicans were really in charge, completely, completely in charge. So it was basically the Republicans are going to win the presidency. And that's fine. Taft wins. Now the thing is, he doesn't follow in Roosevelt's footsteps as Roosevelt had expected. He's not strong enough to really go against the establishment. He really doesn't want to that much. So Roosevelt is so unhappy, he actually says to the Republicans, look, put me in for this next time. Taft's term is going to end. I want you to run me instead of him. And remember what I told you, if you vaguely remember, Washington, George Washington, set the precedent for everyone that came after him. And since Washington stopped after two terms, every president who followed him did that just because he set the example. There was no law that you could only serve two terms. It was just because George Washington did that, everybody else did that. So not until we get a little bit further to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who ran again and again and again, that's when they made the law saying, no, you can only serve two terms. I had mentioned this earlier in the semester. This is just a reminder to you. And so Theodore Roosevelt says, no, I'm going to run a third time. Put me in, he says that to the Republican Party. Republican Party says, that's absurd. Taft has done a good job. He's definitely going to win. There's no doubt he's going to win re-election. Why would we put this wild card in? Why would we put you in? And remember, a lot of these Republicans are the old guard, supporting big business, everything like that. So they really don't want Roosevelt in. They would prefer Taft, who is not the big social reformer and everything like that. So what does Theodore Roosevelt do? He starts his own political party, a third party. And because of his age and everything, he understands people are concerned about his health. So he says, I'm as strong as a bull moose, which is a really strong moose. And he names his party the Bull Moose Party. And that's fine. You get a lot of Republicans who want Taft, this person who is in office, and a lot of other Republicans who want Roosevelt, remembering what a great job he had done, and they want reform. What effect does this have? Well, it splits the Republican vote in two. So they, although they normally would have easily won the presidency, whichever one they had run, Theodore Roosevelt or Taft, would have easily won the presidency. But since they're both running and since they split the vote, for the first time in a long time, a Democrat wins. That Democrat's name is Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson. Now, let's put a pin in that and see what's going on with World War I, because this is the big task that Woodrow Wilson will have to deal with as president. Now, we need to look back in history. We need to look way, 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 way back. And the reason I told you these things throughout the class is because it's very important. So when I bring up Greece and Rome and the Germans, barbarians taking over Rome and taking over Europe and everything like that, it's relevant in 100 different ways. And here's yet another way. These Germans swept in, took down the Roman Empire, took over, and now these German kings are in control. They were chieftains and kings, and that's fine. Now, these kingdoms that they had never really united. They sort of coalesced into this one big entity. See, I maybe shouldn't bring this up, but I'll just say it real quick. It's very important in world history. What happens is, these German barbarians, okay, they're pagans, everything like that, they're savages, and the Catholic Church, as I told you, if you vaguely recall, the Church really was the last institution to preserve civilization and learning and everything like that. If you see, I mean, why do people care about literature and art and music? They don't care, they're just trying to survive. But in the Church, they had reason to know how to read, to keep schedules, you know, you had to pray at certain times, everything like that. So that's great. And the Church made a decision, let's try and convert these Germans. Now, that was a really uphill battle to try and convert and educate these Germans. But they find an ally, the King of the Franks, and the Franks are the German kingdom that do the best, the German tribe that do the best. In fact, they had this special weapon called a francesa. It's like a curved tomahawk. And in fact, they are the ones who found the nation of France. It's named after them and their weapon. Now, with that joint cooperation with the Church educating them, with organization and everything like that, and the Franks being the not only a powerful German tribe, but the most powerful one, they expand and expand and expand, and it winds up dominating all of Europe. And this becomes known, I'm summarizing a lot here, but this becomes known as the Holy Roman Empire. Basically, you have this, the old Roman Empire, which is long since gone, mind you, but you have that idea that this is this super civilized, advanced, this great ideal thing, and the idea is we're bringing it back. And it's holy because it's got the Catholic Church with it, and it's an empire because they're all united all across Europe. Now, this French philosopher named Voltaire famously said it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. But that's what it was called, okay? This big German realm, this big German area. Time goes by. Holy Roman Empire falls apart. Napoleon, maybe it went on for quite a while, but Napoleon basically dissolved it. I mean, Napoleon ran roughshod over all of Europe and everything like that. No more Holy Roman Empire. Later on, it reformed. Not the Holy Roman Empire reformed, but another German realm reformed. And the thing is, there were about 26 different German kingdoms. Remember, Holy Roman Empire, very loosely knit together. So it was a real stretch to call it an empire, but fine. Now, once it was dissolved by Napoleon, there were still about 24 German kingdoms. The strongest of which, they're all pretty strong, but one of them in particular was Prussia, Prussia. P as in Paul, Russia. Prussia. Nothing to do with Russia. It's just has a similar name. That is the ultimate example of military prowess. The best I can give you in all of human history. If you ask me to point to an ideal example of military preparation and planning and strategy and everything like that, that kingdom is the one I would give, that German kingdom. It was said Prussia was not a kingdom with an army. It was an army with a kingdom. In all the other countries, when railroads start coming into being, the business class decides where the rails are going to go, and anything left over, they ask the military, where would you like the rails? In Prussia, the army decides where the rails are going to go. And if there's anything left over, they ask the business class, where would you like these rails? And this kingdom, Prussia, is the one that unites all the rest into one entity, one country called Germany. And it does this, you know, through fighting its neighbors, everything like that, because the neighbors don't want these German kingdoms united. They have enough trouble dealing with them individually. All of them united into one would be way, way, way too powerful. But they're able to do it. They unify more and more and more. And finally, in unifying the northern and southern German kingdoms together, they have to fight France. France doesn't want them unified. This is the Franco-Prussian War. Now, normally you would expect France to win. Much bigger country, bigger population, everything like that. But the Germans are just too good. They wipe the floor with the French. And not only do they demand a huge amount of gold from France, they demand this territory that is like just on the German border called Alsace-Lorraine. Alsace-Lorraine. Don't worry about it, but just understand this is a key thing in what's going to come up. Mind you, they spoke German in the area. It was a border between Germany and France, and you know, the people there, a lot of them spoke German. The culture was very German. So there was a case to be made that Germany should take it, especially since they won this war. But the French don't want to lose even an inch of territory. French soil is sacred to them. They will not give it up. They will fight to the death to keep it. Now here they had to give it up. They would have probably been able to let it go if it was just the money. But losing part of France, Germany, which now becomes united once they beat France, and again, they take this French territory, Alsace-Lorraine. Germany is really, really strong. Now, amazingly, amazingly strong, but it has a permanent enemy in France. Forever, France is going to look to get even with Germany and take back this territory. The thing is, if France got badly beaten by a part of Germany, Now that it's united, and it's massively big and powerful and united, there's a scene in Reservoir Dogs, a line from Reservoir Dogs, "You shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize." That's the situation with France. If France dreams about attacking Germany, it better wake up and apologize. It will have no chance at taking on Germany unless it can get a significant ally. A significant ally. Not Norway or Nicaragua or someplace like that. A big, powerful ally. Then it can beat Germany. So now we had this first realm, this first German realm, which was the Holy Roman Empire. Napoleon took it down, dissolved it. Then you had the second German realm, which is this United Germany. And it's the second realm. Now, they didn't call these things that at the time, but in World War I, Germany loses badly, and this second German realm is dissolved. Shortly afterward, you will have Adolf. We're jumping a little ahead here, but there, I want to clarify this. Shortly after that, you have Adolf Hitler coming to power, and he calls his new era for Germany the Third Realm. But, of course, they're speaking German, so it's known as the Third Reich. That's where that term comes from. You'll hear it translated as empire, and it could be, that's not wrong, but it's more accurately realm. Reich means realm. And we'll get to that, but right now, just understand, now you have this big United Germany, and that's fine. Now, there's another country there, in that general area to the east, called Serbia, S-E-R-B-I-A, Serbia, which one of you went in the military, actually went over there to try and save refugees and everything from these Serbians. The Serbians always seem to be doing something bad. But anyway, the Serbians are Slavic, S-L-A-V-I-C. They are Slavs. That ethnicity has been so badly treated throughout history, enslaved, raped, killed, tortured, everything like that. Our word slave comes from their their name, Slav. It's just the name of their ethnicity. But that's where we get the word slave from. And you see it's an ethnicity in that Eastern European area. You see names of countries in the past, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, that sort of thing. So Slavs, very badly treated, looked down upon, everything like that. And the thing is, there's only one other country that is reasonably that's somewhat admired, reasonably, I can't even say reasonably sophisticated, but reasonably successful. Let's leave it at that. And that is Russia with an R, R-U-S-S-I-A. So Serbia, Slavic country, looks up to Russia because it's the only Slavic country that's sort of successful. And Russia is so not used to being looked up to by anybody. It's a backward country, kind of screwed up, everything like that, that they really like Serbia because it's the one country that really looks up to them. Plus, they're both the same ethnicity. So you have this big brother, little brother type of relationship, and because of that, Serbia is going to be more aggressive than it otherwise would be. Because any time it gets into trouble, it can run to its big brother, Russia. What is Serbia going to do? What does Serbia want? It wants a greater Serbia. It wants to expand. And neighboring it, touching it, is the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Okay? The Austro-Hungarian Empire. In it are multiple different ethnicities, including Slavs. And there's a territory right next to Serbia with a lot of Slavs in it. It's a Slavic territory. under the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and they're not happy because, like Slavs everywhere, they're being badly treated and disrespected and everything like that. So Serbia thinks, okay, we're going to get these people to break away, and then they'll join us, and we'll have more land, more population, more power, everything like that. Fine. Good plan. But the new leader, not the leader, but the upcoming leader, is going to be Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Why is this significant? Well, this new leader, he actually likes the Slavs. He loves the Slavs. He literally loves the Slavs. He's even going to marry one of them. In fact, he is even willing to change the name of the Austro-Hungarian Empire to the Austro-Hungarian Slavic Empire. So now, the Slavs within that empire are actually overjoyed. They're very happy to be a part of this empire, and that is the opposite of what Serbia wants. Serbia wants them unhappy and eager to leave so they will join Serbia. Now, what is Serbia going to do? They have a secret organization within it called the Black Hand. The Black Hand, dedicated to expansion of Serbia at any cost, and the highest level leaders within Serbia are a part of it. So, they hatch a plan to murder the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Now, already, look at how convoluted this is. Just already, look at how convoluted this is. The Serbians are going to assassinate the future leader of Austria-Hungary so he won't do good things for the Slavs, so the Slavs will be unhappy, so they will join with Serbia. This is already a mess. Now, it's very interesting stories and everything like that, but long story short, they assassinate the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And not only do they not apologize for it, try and blame it on some rogue elements or anything like that, the Serbians actually celebrate the assassination of this future leader of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, as you might imagine, the Austro-Hungarians, they want revenge, and they can get it. They can beat Serbia. But what is the problem? The problem is Serbia is backed up by its big brother. Similar ethnicity, everything like that. It's actually, they are Slavic, but Russia is a gigantic country. It always has been. And it's made up of different groups. In fact, the Vikings, a lot of Vikings moved in there and took over. That's why you have two different types of Russians. I mean, you have different ethnicities, especially the further east you go, but some Russians are tall, muscular, very little body fat, blonde hair, blue or gray eyes. Those are descendants of the Vikings who moved in and gave the country its name, the Rus. R-U-S. Those were the Vikings who came in and took over. Then you have other kinds of Russians that are shorter, have more body fat, darker skin, Asian type features. Those were the indigenous people who were there to begin with. And also, the further east you go, the more they have those features. But anyway, it's Russia is like Serbia's big brother. And there's no way Austria-Hungary can beat Russia. So Austria-Hungary goes to its version of a big brother. Same language of German, similar culture, everything like that. That is Germany. So Austria-Hungary goes to Germany. Look what they have done. This, that, all these problems. Will you help us? All we want to do is get justice for what happened to our leader. You see, this is a terrible thing they did, and they celebrated over it. Germany is being led by Kaiser Wilhelm, spelled with a W. Kaiser Wilhelm says, okay, let me see what I can do. Yes, I will support you. He sends a telegram to the leader of Russia, Tsar Nicholas. Listen to the way it's phrased. And I'm going to summarize. Obviously, I'm going to paraphrase it. But Nikki. So this is to Tsar Nicholas. Nikki. Because he knows him so well. And all these European leaders are really related to each other because they marry each other and have kids and everything. So they're all kind of, it's almost like a family feud, a family squabble when there's a problem. But here they all know each other. And Kaiser Wilhelm sends a telegram, Nikki, you know, let's stay out of this. Let's just let the little powers fight it out. Let's not get dragged into it. We don't need to fight. Signed, Willy. So look at how informal this is. Shortly afterward, Tsar Nicholas sends a telegram to Kaiser Wilhelm. Willy, yeah, you're right. Let's stay out of it. Signed, Nikki. Everything seems fine. But a short time later, a second telegram comes from Tsar Nicholas. Listen to the change in tone, which I'm again just summarizing real quick. Kaiser Wilhelm, we intend to support our fellow Slavs no matter what. If you don't wish to get involved in this fight, you need to stay out of it. Signed, Tsar Nicholas. What has happened? Why this 180-degree turn, seemingly all of a sudden? What has happened is this. Russia is filled with many, many discontented groups who want a violent revolution, who want to overthrow the Tsar, kill his family, take over the government, everything like that. And the Tsar's advisors have told him, this could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. If you don't support your fellow Slavs, you might be overthrown. But if you do, firstly, you're getting into a war, and people always support the leader once a war begins. Nothing really unites people as much as a common enemy. So here, it's a matter of self-preservation. The Russian Tsar cannot back down from this. Okay, so what's going to happen here? Well, who has been waiting for a situation like this? Who has been waiting for a significant ally against Germany? Well, France. France, and just so you know, put a pause in things here. Let me just say this. I go through a lot of trouble to make sure there are no visuals. I know it's easier. I know it actually helps you learn and everything like that. But the thing is, as I explained, I believe, on the first day of class, once you strip away the crutch that people are using, these visuals, which I agree, it helps you learn and everything like that. Once you take that away, it forces the verbal ability to get much, much better. Where, God forbid, you should go blind. Yeah, you'll be lost for a while. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be very, very difficult. But what happens to your other senses? They get amped up fairly quickly to a very high level that they never would have gotten to if not for that losing your vision. You see, you know, if you're showing somebody how to punch, how to throw a right cross or something like that, what I do is I put both their arms behind their back, this drill was shown to me, and have them punch with their hip. I hold a mitt right in front of their hip and have them hit with their hip. That way, when they don't have their arm strength to rely on, it forces them to use their legs, put their hip into it, put everything into it. So here, I try not to put in the visuals. But this would be a time, whenever it's maps and everything like that, if you want to see what it's like, if you want to Google a map from that time, or maybe I can even send you one. Let me see what I can do. Essentially, what you need to see is Germany is right there in the center. On one side, to the west, you have France on its border. On the other side, you have Russia, and Germany is sandwiched right between those two countries. So Germany has Russia on its eastern border, France on its western border. So this is like an ideal situation for France. If they can get Russia to go to war with Germany and France will fight at the same time, then France believes it can win. Now, Germany knows this. It demands an immediate treaty from France. Because the Germans are smart. They know the French are salivating at this possibility. They'd love to take advantage of this situation. France refuses to give that treaty. So now Germany knows there's going to be a problem. Germany knows that France is planning to attack. It's just waiting for the right moment. Well, one of the things that made the Prussians so amazing at war is their general staff system. What is that? A general staff is a hand-picked group of experts, the best of the best, to make decisions for the country. And that may seem obvious, but it isn't. Through most of history, and maybe even today, in our own day-to-day lives, how many times do we really go through things methodically, taking the best advice from the most qualified people, everything like that? We don't. You see, they prepare for every possibility in warfare. This country is next to us. Okay, what does it look like? What does the geography look like? What terrain would we have to go through? What are the distances? How many rivers does it have? How deep are the rivers? How wide are the rivers? Do the rivers freeze in the winter? Are there bridges? This, every single detail, including different times of the year. Sometimes you'll have to wear certain types of uniforms, other times not. When we, in the Spanish-American War, which I just mentioned earlier, we sent our troops in wearing woolen uniforms. Woolen uniforms in Cuba in the summer. And this is a thing, even the United States is always doing this. Instead of preparing and then going to war, we go to war and then we prepare. When we first went into Iraq, we gave our people the wrong kind of equipment, the wrong kind. They were even up, what's called up-armoring their vehicles. They were welding scrap metal and everything to the Humvees just to get the appropriate protection. This is the United States of America, and our soldiers had to weld scrap metal to their vehicles because they were the wrong kind of equipment. Anyway. So this is what the Prussians did with their general staff system, and they create plans for when Germany is unified, all the German kingdoms are unified, they keep that same system, and they stay with it, developing everything. The staff system even has plans for going to war with multiple countries. What if we have to go to war with countries A and B at the same time? Or C and E at the same time. What do we do then? And mind you, these plans are constantly being updated. That's another thing people are very deficient with. I don't know if anybody here listening remembers, there was this massive oil spill in the Gulf near Louisiana. A massive oil spill. And okay, something went wrong. How do we fix it? Well, they had a plan there. To their credit, they had a plan there, and they had a point man to call. It was actually a professor at UM. So they say, okay, let's call this guy. Well, he had died. This guy had died, and they hadn't been updating this emergency plan. So when the emergency happened, it wasn't up to date. But the Germans are not like that. Everything was planned out, and everything was updated. They even had a plan for the doomsday scenario. What if we have to go to war with both France and Russia simultaneously? They're right on the doorstep of Germany. Literally, you take one footstep from either country and you're inside Germany. What do you do if you have to go to war with both? Well, they have a plan for that called the Schlieffen Plan, named after Lord Schlieffen, who came up with it. Basically, the Russians, large country, widely dispersed population, backwards in terms of their communication system, their organization, and even their road and rail network. Very crude. It will take them about 5 weeks to get fully mobilized at the German border, ready to fight. About 5 weeks. France, smaller geographic area, not so widely dispersed population, more advanced, better organization, more professional army, everything like that, it will take them 2 or 3 weeks to get fully mobilized and be at the German border ready to fight. The Germans are so good at this. They can be at fully mobilized and at any border, north, south, east, or west, in 26 hours. The leader of Germany, the Kaiser is the name of the leader of Germany, is a title of the leader of Germany. The Kaiser wakes up in the middle of the night, snaps his fingers. 26 hours later, the entire German army, fully mobilized, will be at any border, ready to fight. Fully equipped, everything like that, ready to fight. That's how good the Germans are. So, the plan is, while France is getting ready in this 2-3 week period, the Germans will strike into France, attack while they're still getting ready, knock them out completely. They're going to sweep through from the north all the way down to the south and circle back around back into Germany. Okay? Travel through Germany, travel back through Germany. Now remember, Russia will take 5 weeks, so they still have a few weeks before they're ready to fight. But the Germans, having knocked out France, will sweep back into Germany, cross Germany, and invade Russia while they're still getting ready to fight. Knock out Russia. And that is how Germany will have won this doomsday scenario. They have an excellent plan to do it. But this is plan A. It's also plan B, C, D, E. This is the only plan they have. This is a good plan, but it's the only plan they have. And it's all or nothing. Everything is being staked on this thing. Now, the border, there's a large border between France and Germany, but the thing is, most of it is covered by impassable forest. You can't really move an army through there. One or two guys or a small group of people, yes, but an army, you can't really move them through. There is, to the north, Belgium. Another country named Belgium. Now, it is flat. The terrain there is as flat as a parking lot. We kind of expect that because of where we live here. The land is very flat. But a lot of other land is mountainous or hilly or forested or whatever it is. But Belgium is very flat. It is ideal to send an army through there. So the Germans say to the Belgians, look, we want rights of transit, which means the right to travel through your country. We don't want to take your country. We don't want to fight you. We don't want to take your country. Nothing like that. We just need to get to France. And you happen to be in between, in the only land that's really easily passable for an army. The Belgians think about it, and they respond, Belgium is not a highway, it is a country. Belgium is a country, not a highway, is what they say. Well, guess what? The Germans aren't taking no for an answer. They're going to go through anyway, and that is exactly what they do. Now, the thing is, you have, and yeah, maybe I better send a map with this, but just understand, you have France, you have Germany, you have Russia, okay, just in a row right there. To the north of France and Germany, right in between, but at the very extreme north, you have this country, Belgium, and Germany wants to go through Belgium to get to France. Beyond Belgium, you have the English Channel, which is this body of water, and then you have England. The thing is, the reason this relatively small country of Belgium was able to stay free and independent is because England, which is the United Kingdom, which has all these colonies all over the world, it's still really, really powerful. England has kept Belgium free. And that's partly because Belgium is the ideal jumping-off point for an invasion of England. And therefore, England doesn't want this area, this land area, to fall under the control of any big power like France or Germany or anything like that. And so it's in England's best interest for the Belgians to be free and unthreatened. Because if a big power takes it, it will be in a perfect position to invade England. Now that Germany is going to invade Belgium, now this threatens England. Now, England and France have had a hatred of each other going back about 1,000 years. Constantly fighting, going to war, everything like that. It's calmed down a lot in the last few decades. But it's still, they've got their problems with each other and everything like that. But back then, France and England were basically enemies. Not at war, but they were enemies. But a threat like this, now England is ready to come in to fight Germany, which would put it on the side of France. So, look at this situation. Now look at how complicated and convoluted this is. Slavic Serbia assassinates the leader, the future leader, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so that the Slavs within it will not be happy and will want to break away and join Serbia. Which means the Austro-Hungarians want revenge on Serbia. So Serbia runs to Russia to protect it. And that brings Russia into the war, which requires Austria-Hungary to run to its big brother, Germany, which brings Germany into the war, which allows France to have an opportunity to get revenge on Germany and maybe take back its territory, Alsace-Lorraine, which requires Germany to attack Belgium to get to France. So it brings Belgium into the war. But that threatens England because it's a perfect invasion point to invade England, which brings in England into the war, which brings in the entire United Kingdom, which is all these other countries and colonies which England has around the world. Look at that. And this is a good time to remember back when we talked about getting a treaty ratified in America. This is a good time to remember it is really, really difficult to get a treaty in America. It is as difficult as anything I can think of. It is easier to go to war, for America to go to war, for the president to take us to war, than it is to get a treaty signed. Because a treaty is a serious commitment. An economic treaty, a military treaty. Once we commit to something, we may get dragged into a war that just spirals way, way, way out of control. Now, how is Germany going to handle this? Well, it's going to put its plan into effect. But there were two things different from the plan. First, the plan really expected the Belgians not to fight. They did. They resisted, and that slowed the Germans down a little bit. Second, the plan called for Germany to send everything it had against France, knock it out, and then come back and send everything it had against the Russians. But the Germans say, you know, a lot of time has passed, you know, maybe this is a little reckless. What we'll do is we'll send 90% of our forces, almost all of it, we'll hold 10% back, and send 90% against the French. Just in case the Russians get ready early, we'll have that 10% here to protect us. So this 90% goes through, and because it's short in forces, they aren't able to take Paris. That would have to stretch the line too far. If they had all 100% that the plan called for, they could have taken Paris, and there's a good chance this plan would have succeeded. But they bypass Paris. It's not a military area. You know, we don't really need it. They bypass it. Now, something happens that's pretty ridiculous, and only the French would really do something like this. Well, the Germans are invading, sweeping through France, making rapid progress. word gets to the French troops in Paris who are on vacation, you know, on leave, celebrating, enjoying themselves. And they say, oh, France is being invaded. And they rush out to meet this invading force. They are not equipped. They don't have their heavy artillery. They don't have any artillery. They don't even have transportation. They commandeer any vehicle they can, taxi cabs, whatever it is, and drive out there. Now, the German commander gets a report there is a French enemy force at his back. Because remember, they bypass Paris and they're sweeping through the rest of France, but now some military force has come out of Paris. And he needs to know what to do. What do we do? You never want an enemy at your back, especially when you're fighting an enemy in front of you. That's a very dangerous situation. But if he stops, he loses his momentum. When you're beating back an enemy, you want to keep them off balance. Keep hitting, hitting, hitting. Don't let up, because then they'll get their bearings. They'll dig in. You're going to lose your whole advantage. The German commander decides to stop, deal with this new enemy force, and then keep going. It turns out to be nothing, as I described to you. Just people in taxi cabs and handguns and things like that. It was nothing. It would have been like a mosquito bite, if even that. But by the time the German commander figures this out, it is too late. The French have gotten their bearings, have dug in, and now, well, they have actually literally dug in. They have dug in trenches on both sides, because now technology, which I kind of told you before in the previous lecture, we've been multiple times in human history on the cusp of amazing possibilities with new technology and new developments and everything, but frequently, you know, off the top of my head, always, we tend to turn it toward dark efforts, toward violence toward each other, toward whatever it is, and this is an extreme example of that. Because of new technological developments and everything like that, warfare has become far, far more deadly than it has ever been before. You have machine guns, you have poison gas, you have barbed wire, you have heavy artillery on a scale you've never seen before. You have massive amounts of troops in the millions on each side. And not only the ability to send them out, but the ability to supply them with food and everything like that, which had never existed before in the past. And warfare has become so deadly, you really can't survive above ground. You have to dig these trenches and you stay there. Now, you never want an enemy going around you, going around your flanks, so you expand your trench as wide as possible so they can't get around you. Now again, because we have so many resources by the time of World War I, so many new technologies allowing massive armies and everything like that, they build these trenches really, really wide. It's like a race between the Germans and the French who can expand their trenches further, faster. So rapidly, rapidly, both sides keep expanding their trenches wider and wider and wider until they hit ocean on one side and impassable mountain range on the other. What does this mean? It means there's no way to flank the enemy. Flank means get to their side or get behind them. There's no way to do that because the trenches expand all the way from the ocean to the mountain. So there is literally no way around it. You must rush straight at it when you're attacking. And this was always a bad idea, but now with machine guns and things like that, this is a horribly, horribly bad idea. But there's no other choice. And this becomes a monstrously devastating, devastating war. It is really the worst event in human history, in my opinion. Frankly, it's most people's opinions. Just to give you a tell, now, this war originally becomes known as the Great War because they had never seen anything like it. They had never seen anything like what they're going to see in this war. ultimately, after it is over, it becomes known as the war to end all wars. The war to end all wars, because it is so horrifying and the consequences are so devastating. People thought, well, at least one good thing came out of this. Humanity will never go to war again. This has really taught us a lesson. But of course, we shortly after that have another gigantic war, and so this becomes known as World War One. Anyway, here with these trenches, you have the trenches on each side, the German side, the French side, and the British are on the French side as well. And in between, you have what's known as no man's land. That's the area across which you have to rush at the enemy. And it is just a slaughter. A slaughter. Now, you oftentimes would get killed there. Usually very high fatality rate, enormously high fatality rate. But oftentimes you would get injured. Okay, you're injured. Now, obviously, if you're closer to your own trench, you would try and crawl back into your own trench. If you were closer to the enemy's trench, you would try and crawl into the enemy's trench. Because even though they're the enemy, there's a certain code of conduct in war. Even if you haven't signed the Geneva Conventions or anything like that, no agreement, there's a certain code of conduct in war. When you're injured, your enemy will take care of you and heal you and everything like that, especially because next week it may be them who's injured and captured by the enemy, and they don't want to be tortured or whatever it is. So ideally you wouldn't be injured at all, but if you were, you'd crawl back into your own trench. If necessary, if absolutely necessary, you'd crawl into the enemy's trench. And you'd be a prisoner of war and everything like that, but you'd be taken care of. They wouldn't torture and kill you. But let's say you were there in no man's land, you were injured, and you tried and tried, but you weren't able to make it into either your own trench or your enemy's trench. You saw the sun starting to go down. You would raise your hand and ask to be shot by either side. Why would you do that? What's the big deal with the sun going down? Millions of giant rats would come swarming out to devour anything they saw. How had they gotten so numerous and so huge? Eating the bodies of these basically young kids, 18 years old, 19 years old. A lot of them lied. They were 16 or 17 or even 15. They thought, oh, I'm going to see the world. I'm going to protect my country. It's this noble, great, heroic thing. They have no idea what they're getting into. But they do. They learn it. And here, you did not want to be alive when those rats started devouring you. So, this is only a part of what World War I was like. And we're going to get into that next lecture.